I was thinking of something that's going to seem highly irrelevant, but I hope I can make it all relate. Many years ago in our community, when many of the children who are now grown-up adults were small, there was a period of time when we had 9 boys kind of going like this, and you would look out the window and you'd see 8 of them who were essentially the same age running, and then the smallest, who was Ryan Cabillo, just a few paces behind, trying to catch up the whole time. And the boys were enjoyable but unpredictable. And they ran pretty free in our community, and there's a driveway that goes around in a circle. And we became quite concerned that those children, being oblivious to the concept of traffic, might get hurt by one of those cars. So we put in speed bumps, which nobody likes, speed bumps. So we put in really big speed bumps, and everybody had to slow down. And then there was actually this cycle that happened of enormous protest because of those speed bumps. People had to slow down so much. And so then there was an actual conversation that we were going to shave down the speed bumps so that people wouldn't have to slow down so much. I said, which one of those people wants to be the first to run over a child? You know, of course we want those speed bumps to be unbelievably inconvenient, so that everybody will have to stop. Okay? Now, we just left them, and you do have to really go over slow speed bumps, and sometimes you hit the bottom of your car, and that whole generation of children grew up unscathed, and the next generation of children is doing really well too, and we're really happy about that. But I was thinking, just in this example, which was ridiculous to me at the time that it happened, these speed bumps make us slow down, we need to do something about them. Duh. You know, that's why they're there, is to slow you down. How much we live in our own universe. And we make up this list of what our priorities are, and we have such a hard time recognizing that we're not really dealing with reality. We're just dealing with the arbitrary combination of our karmic conditions that have brought us to this position, and what I want is what I want. Just like that. When we were very first new in our community, when we first took it over, we lease it, we don't own it, and it was still occupied by the previous crowd of tenants, which, let's just say the Mountain View police were really glad when we took over, and they were able to reduce their force by quite a bit because we'd taken over. It was people who tended to live a little more on the fringe. And David and I had moved into a small apartment right on the driveway side while we were getting settled. And one morning at 6:30 in the morning, Saturday morning, somebody pulled his car up right next to the buildings, which means that your bedroom window is about as far as I am from where this front row is, put his car right there. He turned on his radio full blast, opened his hood, and began to do some car repairs. 6:30 on Saturday morning, like this. But the thought that the first thing that occurred to me is, he doesn't know. He just doesn't know that there's anybody on the planet but him. It's 6:30, have a little time off, car needs work, boring without the radio, here's a convenient spot. You know that there was 50 people sleeping, just didn't cross his mind, literally. Because, you know, I'm here, this is what I want, this is what I'm going to do. And what I also enjoyed was the thought that that karma is going to come back on him. He'll be somewhere, and somebody will be utterly inconsiderate of his values, and he'll be absolutely outraged. And more than that, completely bewildered. How dare they? And the relationship between what he was doing to the rest of us and what's being done to him is just all just a complete mystery. You know, so people just sit in the bars and rant about who's terrible and why they're terrible and plot their revenge, and whoa, there we go, on and on and on and on. And it's really a never-ending cycle, almost never-ending, because eventually we suffer too much. And I think it's so sweet. Master used to say that he used to have an argument with Divine Mother, and his argument with Divine Mother was, why do you have to make people suffer so much? You know, Master had a very tender heart. Masters have the most tender hearts of all because they can see the whole story. You know, they can see that the trajectory of that man turning on the radio, and they can watch it for how many incarnations and how many cycles of suffering are going to take place, not just because he woke us up. That's not going to really last very long, but the whole mindset, it just goes on and on. I was reading a little bit of advice Swami Kriyananda was giving to one of the Ananda ministers. He said, don't worry so much about whether or not people are happy right now. He said, think more in terms of helping them to put an end to all suffering. And he was talking in another context about, no, this was Sister Gyanamata, who's a disciple of, who's the most advanced woman disciple of Yogananda, of Master. And she wrote, she said, Master, because she was writing a letter of advice to one of the nuns there. And apparently the nun was kind of in a snit over something that Master had done that had hurt her feelings. That was the phrase that Gyanamata was working with. He said, she said, Master does not care at all whether your feelings are hurt. Master wants to put an end to all suffering for all eternity. And this is the way we have to learn. We have to begin to understand not only that we are not the center of the universe, the only thing there is. Swamiji was fond of telling a story of his little niece who said to her mother, Swami's cousin at one time, she said, Mommy, what do you think about all day? And she says, oh, I think about you children, and I think about the house, and I think about the things that I have to do, and the neighbors. She mentioned a few things. And the little girl said, oh, I only think about myself. And then she just scattered and ran off. Just perfectly honest. The only thing that's important to me is me. I remember how strange it is when you begin to recognize as a child that your parents actually exist. And to actually cognize your parents as fully free adults. Well, I'm still working on it. I'm still realizing, I'm sure you all do too. You know, oh, my mother was this age when? And how different it looked to me when I was her. It happens when I look at my hands and I think they're my mother's. Oh, it's just so startling. You know, there it is. And so that must have been that she was my age when. The entire process of the spiritual life is shifting that perspective. Just shifting it from everything that happens in the world is about me to realizing that I am as much a part of everything as I am of the one that I'm most familiar with. And this is what the power of a master is. This is the simple difference between a master and the rest of us. And the most important thing to recognize, which is totally lost outside of the path of self-realization, I mean in most traditional religions, is that these great masters, Jesus Christ, whose birthday we are celebrating right now, who the whole world with awe-filled admiration and love sees, but almost no one really understands that at one point, that actual soul, that living individual entity that is Jesus Christ, pulled his car up outside somebody's bedroom window and turned the radio on so loud. Meaning it is something that we learn. And when a few weeks ago I talked to you about reincarnation, and I talked at some length about what happened to spiritual teachings when Christianity dropped reincarnation. Because among other things, we no longer understood that you become a Christ by the ever-persistent determination in your own heart to escape suffering and to find perfect bliss. And this is what we go through over and over and over again. It's always, and Master argues with Divine Mother, why do you make your children suffer? But then Master himself says he's noticed that it seems to work. That unless something really forces us to ask ourselves, who am I? Why was I born? And where does happiness come from? We just keep going. We just keep going until something catches us. And it's just no fun when those big tests come to us. I can talk as good a story as anyone else, but it's no fun. It's no fun to be pushed to the wall and to try to find out what you're made of. But unfortunately, it's a method that works. Because there's an irony to Ananda that I've noticed over the years, which is when people are having the hardest time, I myself or others, that's when everybody says to you, "Ah, oh, you look so wonderful. Your eyes are just shining. You just emanate so much joy." And that's because, whoa, everything has come into a focus like that. And there's no margin here. There's no margin at all. We're just going to go right down that middle. I remember my friend Paula, who I spoke about in the Finding Happiness movie. She's my teacher, even all these years after she's passed. When she got cancer three times. The third time took her. The first time she got it, she was the sweetest person I knew. But she said, "You know what, Asha? I just don't have the margin to have a single negative thought." She said, "I've just used them all up. I can't use any more. You know, I've got cancer. I have to be really careful now." And I never knew her to have a negative thought, but I guess she saw some room for improvement. But I've got cancer. I've used up my margin. Now, this is why the masters live and show us who they are. And this is why it's very important also in our relationship to the masters to understand that this one to whom I'm praying to help me is my friend on a level that we literally cannot imagine. We literally cannot imagine. There's some words of Sister Gyanamata. We have a play coming up in a month, which is about disciples of Master, and my part in the play, as it happens, is Gyanamata. So I'm very familiar. I've been spending a lot of time with her, which is really good company. But at one point she says to Master in a note, and she's offering him her devotion. She says, "For all that you are that I know you to be, and for all that you are that I can never know." And then she offers her devotion to him for all of these reasons. But I was thinking about that, about Jesus being born and this being the Christmas season. And we have this wonderful story, and for 25 years or more here in this temple, in other locations before we were here. But I've been retelling that Christmas story, and I especially tell it on Christmas Day for the children. When we first started doing our Christmas Day service, which is at noon, and it's a family service, it's for the children. So even though the room has many adults, we tell the story so the children will understand it. The nice thing about telling it for children is that we all can then understand it. That's what works. I asked Swami to write the children's Bible, the children's Gita, the children's autobiography, because then we would understand it. And when we first started doing it, I got from a midwife friend an exact, anatomically correct newborn baby. It was a little plastic baby that the midwife would use to help train mothers and help the siblings. And this baby was so lifelike. It disappeared somehow. It vaporized, and we replaced him with a Catholic baby that we bought in Rome that you'll see on Christmas Day. He's a beautiful Bambino Gesù. That's what they call him. But I had this baby, and the first year that we were doing this Christmas story, I was just, getting used to the baby. And I had him in our house, and I was carrying him around. And on Christmas Day, I had him all wrapped up, and I was walking out to the car, and somebody drove by, and it was like, "Did Asha and David have a baby?" It was just like, how did I not get the message on this one? Because he'd become so completely alive to me. Just, I was talking about what a great life he was going to have, just putting myself in the mood. But I'd gone past the mood. It was the baby Jesus. And, I'm being as careful with him as you would have to be with a real child, so much so that someone thought it must be. But relating to the masters with that kind of commitment And right now we're talking about the baby, and we're talking about the love that emanates from that child, and therefore the freedom that we feel in order to give that love. Why is it that we are so lost in our own realities? It's always fear. Everything comes down to fear. You know, what will happen if? In Swamiji's magnificent song, whatever they call it now, Walk Like a Man, I think it's called. And one of the lines in there is, give life your heart, bless everything that's grown. Fear not the loving. All this world's your own. I think of all of Swami's songs, and I've been listening to them for 40 years. Somehow the verse that comes back to me over and over and over and over again is that one. Give life your heart. Just think about what that would feel like. You know, Master said that imagination plays a great part in spiritual life. And it's interesting. I mean, the creative art, Swami talks about the importance of creativity, to be able to see a reality that is not already right there in front of you. I mean, this is the sheer lack of imagination is that man turning on his radio right outside our window. His world was so circumscribed by what was right in front of his nose that he just couldn't imagine that anybody had any other reality except fixing his car right then. And so it's often magnificent to take these enormous spiritual possibilities and just in the privacy of our own hearts, imagine what it would feel like. Just that phrase, give life your heart. And then we have to ask ourselves, why do I not do that every day? Why do I not walk out every day unprotected? More than a decade ago, I had LASIK surgery on my eyes. I wore glasses since I was 9 years old, although I didn't wear them until I was about 11 all the time, because I thought I looked prettier without my glasses on. And then one day I looked over and her name was Missy Raitt. Actually, I wore them all the time since I was 9, because I looked over at this girl, her name was Missy Raitt, and I realized that she was pretty with or without her glasses. And it crossed my mind that that was not really the deciding factor. So I put on my glasses and developed a witty personality. But when I took them off after I had the LASIK surgery, it was an extremely interesting experience because I suddenly felt enormously vulnerable. You know, you just like, I'd always had this literally a shield right on my face all the time. And when I took it off, it was just the feeling of being seen, oddly enough, and also having no barrier between myself and the world. I mean, it was such a trivial thing in itself, but symbolic of so much, isn't it? Of all the barriers that we erect between ourselves and the world. And how much? What are you thinking about? Oh, I think about myself all the time. In all circumstance, I'm just worried about me. That's just what's going on here. What are people thinking? How am I doing? What do I look like? Just amazing, isn't it? Give life your heart. Now, what if the energy turns into blessing? Bless everything that's grown. Fear not the loving. All this world's your own. Now, see, that's the power of the masters. They have lived through it and lived through it and suffered and suffered and suffered and suffered until that sense of who am I has moved from this self-protective vulnerability that I'm going to get my feelings hurt to the end of all sufferings. There's no I to have my feelings hurt. We, of course, are talking about Christmas right now, but everybody knows that the end of Jesus' story is not so cheerful. We were in with Swamiji in Taormina, Italy, which is a island water sort of place. I can't exactly think where it is right now, but in any case, it was a small place, small little town, and we walked every day past this mosaic of Mary with the baby Jesus. And Swami was always, he always had something new and amusing to say about that particular Mary. She just really looked shell-shocked. He had several names for her, you know, Mary the Reluctant. She just looked like, she's sitting here holding the baby and her face looked like, what have I gotten myself into? She looked anything but like the joyous mother of God. And so Swamiji, in his way, because this world was all his own, he was never inhibited. He goes into a shop right next to where this mosaic thing is, and he sort of takes the shop, the clerk, out, and he says, look at her, why does she look so unhappy? He says, she's just given birth to the mother of God. Shouldn't she be cheerful looking? And then he intones very ponderously, well, she knows already that he's going to come to a tragic end. I mean, that was his answer. Oh, all right. So let's be miserable right from the start. You know, he was just pushing, as he always did. He always just pushed a little bit to try to expand people's thinking about everything. But Jesus did come to a tragic end, in the sense that he did not triumph in the world. He did not fulfill the hope of his own disciples. His own disciples thought he was the predicted Messiah who was going to liberate the Jewish people. And to most of his disciples, not all, but most of them, that was going to have a very specific physical form. He was going to overthrow the corrupt priesthood. He was going to become the leader of their people, and he was also going to throw off the political yoke of the Romans. He was the destined one. He would free them. Freedom is a little different the way Jesus meant it. But instead, he was arrested, he was tortured, he was crucified, and he died in a rather unpleasant way. However you look at it, it appeared unpleasant. In the midst of that, even as he was taking his last breaths in that physical body, he looked at the very ones who had done this to him and prayed for their salvation. Father, forgive them. He said, they don't know what they're doing. Because this was, you know, turning on your radio at 6:30 in the morning is a pretty small transgression compared to crucifying Jesus. That was a bad thing to do. That was a real mistake on their part. May have seemed like a good idea at the time, but it was a bad one. And Jesus, looking right at them, could see the cycle of suffering that their misunderstanding was going to set in motion. And he inserted himself between them and the consequences of their own behavior, which is something a master can do. He prayed to Father, Father meaning the impersonal force of the universe, and asked that that karma be expiated. It was a profound and astonishing prayer. Now, how do you get to that point? That wasn't an act of great discipline on his part. That wasn't an affirmation. He didn't say, I forgive you. Because there was no I even to be concerned. He asked that their own karma be mitigated. And it was a spontaneous gesture on his part. He didn't do it for effect. It was because for many, many, many incarnations, he'd been realizing that this world is my own. There is no edge. All of these edges are imaginary, and all of these pains are imaginary. Yes, we experience them. God knows we experience them. As Master said, if you hit your dream head on a dream stone, you have a dream pain. It doesn't matter if ultimately it dissolves. As long as we're living on that level, we're experiencing it. And so every single day, literally every moment of every day, is this supreme effort to bring ourselves back to center and to overcome that fear. That fear of just being who we are. And sometimes that means just, it's not pretty. It's just not pretty. We spend so much of our time trying to not see what we are. Swamiji advised this woman once. She was so insecure in her nature, just constantly insecure. And Swami had been helping her for years, essentially the same issues. And He said one day to her, he said, look, nothing else seems to have worked. So just for the sake of experiment, let's try this. Every terrible thing you imagine about yourself is true. Okay, now what? Now what? I mean, overcoming fear, you have to be courageous and you have to use your imagination. Okay, it's all true. This life is a total bust. And all the promise of it is zero. It's just been a waste. Okay, so now what? Upon the ashes of my absolute shattered dreams, what'll I do now? That's how you get that kind of courage. Think how many tragedies there are in life, how many times people fail to live up to their own ideals, fail to live up to their own potential, take a wrong turn, take that drink after 25 years of sobriety, and then it's all over again. Just over and over. Now here's the secret that you have to contemplate. If anyone has ever done it in any incarnation, so did Jesus. So did Paramhansa Yogananda. So did every great master and every great saint you've ever seen. So did Swami Kriyananda, ever. And they got there from here. No devotee is ever lost. God is everywhere. The last lines of today's reading. He who keeps his gaze and sees me everywhere never loses sight of me, because everywhere he looks, he's seeing God. And then the line that's the most important to me, and I never lose sight of him. Now, at first, that is a little frightening, isn't it? Swamiji said, Master said, I know every single thought that you think. Swamiji said, Master said that to me. He said, at first, you might be a little dismayed by that. But then Swamiji realized that he was so grateful, because there was no way or place or depth or confusion that he could ever fall into that Master wasn't walking right there with him. And even more, that Master knew the terrain. Oh, look, yes, I know. Yes, you're up to your ankles in mud and your knee is caught in the vice. Well, this is how we deal with it. Give life your heart. Bless everything that's grown. Fear not the loving. All this world's your own. God bless you.